This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi, inviting you to enter the world of arts, cultural affairs, and entertainment with Q's video podcast. Feature interviews with the people and personalities shaping, captivating, and challenging culture. Delivered to your mobile device 3 times a week, visit cbc.ca/Q to subscribe to the Q video podcast and watch what we're doing.
I'm Pauline Dakin. Welcome to Maritime Magazine. Until recently, few people talked about prescription drug deaths. Families were too shocked or embarrassed. Police and health officials perhaps more concerned with alcohol-related problems or hard drugs such as heroin, cocaine, and crystal meth. Amy Graves has gone a long way towards changing that, at least in Nova Scotia. But it was never part of her life plan. Margot Brunel brings us her story.
I first met Amy by phone. Not that long ago, really. But once you're on her contact list, you hear from her often.
Hi.
You on the phone?
No, I'm good. Actually, I called Leo back and he's not in the office, though.
Sometimes I get three or four emails a day and night. She is relentless.
This is my new place. I've been here since February.
Yeah. And here is the computer.
Yeah.
The computer where you spend most of your life, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Everything I do is done on that. A lot of people think that I have like this little organization where I have people working.
A company.
Yeah, but it's far from that. It's me in my little apartment with my cheap laptop.
Have you got pictures?
Yeah.
Photos?
This is...
Her hair is tied back in a tight ponytail. She doesn't dress up or down. She'd blend in almost anywhere. But look again. Amy's eyes are hyper-alert to what's going on around her.
Oh, I know in high school, I didn't even know what these prescription drugs were. I didn't even know what they were made of. They're synthetic heroin. They're chemically the same as heroin. And I had no clue. I don't think a lot of other people do.
She's learned the hard way not to let things sneak up on her.
Then you look at, you know, pictures of people. It makes me sad. In high school, I mean, I look at these pictures and this young man here, he looks like a bright, nice face. He robbed our local pharmacy for pills from his addiction since we've been in high school. He's the one who overdosed in the coma across the street from the school.
Oh.
This young boy here, IV drug user, been on methadone for the past 10 years.
Young faces. Sure, they look like they might get into a bit of mischief, but then they'll grow up. Not these kids, though. Not the way they planned. And not Amy's brother, Josh.
I can remember when Josh came home from out west, he didn't even knock on my door. It scared the living you-know-what out of me because I just had this baby. It was just me and the baby home, and my door opens and this big guy comes in with this black jacket and I scream and it's my brother from out west, you know? And he was just as happy as could be. Couldn't wait to see the baby. That was the first place he went when he got off the plane, was to see my son.
It was like the beginning of a new life for both Amy and Josh. Her with a baby and plans to get married. Josh, finally back in Nova Scotia.
He had just secured his new place, went out, bought a new mattress, new bed, bought furniture, gave them the delivery to deliver it to the new place, and died that evening.
3 weeks after coming home, Josh was dead at the age of 21.
He never even got to sleep a night in his new apartment. The thing that is the hardest is you always think that when someone that close to you goes, so you'd have some feeling, you would know something is wrong.
There were no warnings, no sirens, no visit from the police. More than halfway through a pretty normal Saturday, Amy got the call from her sister.
I just screamed. I felt like I was a little baby. I just fell on the floor, screaming, 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 crying, crying, crying. I couldn't even ask why. I just wept on the floor.
At least Amy was at home when she got the news. Her other brother was buying groceries.
He was talking on the phone to my mother in the grocery store. And all of a sudden, his girlfriend started just screaming, losing it in the store, running through the aisles. Just screaming, "He's dead, he's dead, he's dead." And my mom could hear it over the phone. And he said, "Mom, I think you better go get Dennis."
Who's Dennis?
Her boyfriend. And that's when he told her. She said, "Just tell me, Kyle, just tell me what's going on." And he said, "Courtney says Josh is dead."
Josh was dead for most of a day before Amy and her family found out. None of them were notified by police. What followed was a bizarre chain of events.
Well, my brother was found in an addiction counselor's home. The police weren't even called all day. He laid in that house until about 3 p.m. that day, dead. She went to her job that morning, her addictions counseling job. And this is what she wrote me. I have it in writing, wrote my mother. Said she thought Josh was sleeping. She didn't realize he was dead. And she said her sister stopped by her house and saw Josh's shoes still there. Her sister said, "I think he's dead. He's blue. I think he's dead." And the addictions counselor was all this training instead of saying, "Call the ambulance." She said, "Okay, I'll be right home." She walked home before calling an ambulance. When she got to her house, her and her sister decided to call their mother. So they called their mother. And then the mother went to the house to look at my brother. Then the mother called the police, and then the mother started calling. Called, actually, my brother's girlfriend, who was in the grocery store. He was dating that addictions counselor. He loved her. He did. And that's why my family tried to accept it so much in the beginning. She came to the funeral. It was kind of like, you know, accidents happen. We didn't know the details either to what had gone on. So we didn't judge. We weren't angry. We didn't blame her.
You were in shock.
Yeah, like we didn't know what to think of it. But the first kind of inkling that, you know, maybe something shady had happened was at the funeral. She was saying, "Oh my God, I'm going to get fired over this. I'm going to get fired over this." And that was when the light bulb in my head went off. Why is she talking about her job at my brother's funeral?
That light bulb hasn't dimmed since that moment. Amy decided right then that she was not going to let Josh's death be written off as a simple accident.
Right from the get-go, I wanted to educate everybody that this is going on. Because my brother wasn't the first. One of his best friends that he grew up with died just a year before Josh, just over a year before, from the same thing, abusing prescription drugs. And I can remember when he went, my brother Josh was devastated. He just shook his head and thought, what a waste. And that's why it was such a shock to me that he would make the same choice.
And did you find out what he took?
Yeah, he took Dilaudid, about 11 milligrams, and less than a pint of alcohol, not even a pint. And he was a perfectly healthy person, no medical issues, athletic, I mean. You would never think something. He only took a third of a pill. It was a Dilaudid 30 that they cut up into three pieces.
Of course, you'll never know for sure. But Amy is convinced that prescription drugs were never part of Josh's lifestyle.
I don't feel like anyone forced it down his throat, but I really feel like he made an uneducated choice. If he knew that mixing it with alcohol would result in that consequence, I don't think he would have done it. He wasn't an unhappy person. He actually was doing the best he had ever done in his life.
And there was absolutely no reason to consider his death a suicide.
He had just got a promotion to come back to Nova Scotia. He was hiring some of his friends, which he was so proud that his buddies were going to be working for him. He thought that was great.
What was he doing?
He was an arborist. He had just bought a new car. He was like so excited, loving life. No criminal record, no history of addiction. That's why it was so surprising and just so heart-wrenching that, you know, he had everything going for him. Hello? Hi. Thank you.
A few days after her brother's death, Amy went to the police herself. She took photos and letters she found on Facebook telling what had happened to Josh. But the RCMP said it was too soon to do anything with the evidence. They were waiting for a toxicology report to show how he died.
So I was kind of disappointed. I thought, oh, well, shouldn't they get a head start just in case, you know, it does turn out? Like, we can be working on stuff while we wait for the toxicology. But I thought, okay, they're the professionals. They're the police officers. I'll let them do their job. Months and months passed, 6 months since his death, and the toxicology came back. Dilaudid and alcohol, nothing less, nothing more. That was it. Only things in his system. So I immediately called up the RCMP and I said, I mean, this is kind of good news, isn't it? This proves that it was the Dilaudid that killed my brother. This proves that all these statements that I have from people saying that so-and-so sold my brother Dilaudid, can you now start questioning people? And that's when they told me, sorry, Miss Graves, now that we have the toxicology, the case is closed. We know that he died from a drug overdose, so that's all we need to know. I said, well, how do you know? If you've done no investigation, if you haven't talked to the people from the party, how do we know he took it willingly? So I think RCMP far too often say, oh, they're not going to talk to me. There's no point. When really, you can't just assume. You're the RCMP. Your job is to find the facts, not to assume.
Amy doesn't mince words. And she's made some people mad because she's so outspoken. Many of them are quick to point out that the prescription drug problem is not unique to the Annapolis Valley or to this part of Canada. Amy agrees.
In the next hour, you'll meet James McGilvery, who watched his son go from a strapping, healthy young man with a great future through horrendous addiction.
She's found families all over North America who are fighting the same battle.
I have an article. We're going to start the show right off with a caller. We have Amy on the line. Amy, are you there?
Yes, I am.
How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for calling in. Now, we wanted to talk real quick about the article that I read. You filed a complaint against the police in your in your community?
Mm-hmm. I did. My brother passed away from an accidental overdose to Dilaudid and alcohol in March of this year.
Mm-hmm.
So when the police arrived, they didn't treat it as a crime scene. People showed up to view my brother's body, like people who are at the party. People were touching my brother, taking pictures of my brother.
What?
Yeah. And then
6 months after Josh's death, Amy started a blog called Get Prescription Drugs Off the Streets. It averages 100 hits a day, almost 30,000 hits in less than a year. But Amy has also become a target. She's had frightening threats from people who depend on easy access to drugs like Dilaudid and OxyContin.
When I started actually becoming successful, I would say, and reaching some of my goals, such as prescription monitoring being made 24/7.
Nova Scotia's prescription drug monitoring program got launched in 2005. Last summer, in August 2011, the province finally extended its reach, so pharmacists can now access patient profiles 24/7.
The harder the pills get defined, the more threats and complaints I get. On one hand, it shows that obviously I'm creating change and making a difference because people are being affected. And the people who are being affected in a bad way are the drug dealers and the diverters. Watch your mouth, lady. You better keep your mouth shut. We know more about you than you think. And I get that all threats are made by fake Facebook accounts, anonymous emails. I mean, I'm only 26. I can't go out to clubs anymore. I can't go out to any kind of nightlife functions. If there's a barbecue or a party or anything like that, I usually can't go because there's always somebody on the guest list who doesn't agree with what I'm doing or is still in active addiction. Or, you know, so many of my peers are still caught up in this pill game and pill business that I just don't feel comfortable going out anymore because I fear for my safety. This is an album, actually, that my grandmother made me of all kind of the work I've done, and me and Josh.
That's missing you on the front.
Yeah. We all miss him so much.
Page after page of newspaper articles chronicle Amy's campaign to get prescription drugs off the street. Here's the demonstration that you held.
Yeah. She snipped out every article that has come out since the beginning. That's my grandmother right there, actually. She even comes out and holds the signs.
That protest with her grandmother happened in front of the Mud Creek Medical Cooperative. It's a couple of blocks from Wolfville's Main Street, within view of rolling farmland on the edge of town. Mud Creek is a private clinic. It opened in 2004 when Dr. William Doran arrived from BC. For several years, he was one of few physicians in Nova Scotia licensed to administer methadone. Some people believe this is one clinic addicts can rely on for prescription painkillers. 2 weeks ago, MLA Leo Glavine told a public forum in Halifax, quote, "We have a huge problem at the Mud Creek Clinic in Wolfville." But Dr. Doran disputes that. You've had a long, busy day, right? This is a very busy clinic.
That's correct.
Somebody told me people are bussed in to your clinic to get their methadone. They come from all over the province.
There is a huge need for physicians to do methadone maintenance in Nova Scotia. We're short at least 60 doctors, and so, yeah, people go where they have to go. Part of my job is to advocate for people who need treatment and to support and encourage government agencies to establish programs, and that's what I've been doing for years. And so that's my role at the moment, is being the one of the physicians, not the only one, but one of the physicians in the new program in the Valley.
I've done a lot of interviews about this subject in the last, even with you, in the last 2 years or so. And every once in a while I hear very pointed criticism about the way this clinic is run, and that there are too many young people coming here for their prescriptions. What do you say to those people who make those accusations about the clinic?
They're not here. I don't have any way to have a dialogue with them. I don't know what the basis of those criticisms that you report. I don't know what the complaint is.
The complaint is you're giving too many people painkillers when they don't really need them, and they're selling them on the street.
Well, I think that's extremely rude of you.
I'm just asking because I hear those rumors. I think it's only fair to ask you.
No, I think that's gossip and slander. And I don't think that it's an appropriate question, and I take offense at it.
I respect your opinion. That's fair enough.
Excuse me. Okay, I gotta go.
Okay, sorry. I appreciate your time. Some are stolen from pharmacies, but almost all the prescription drugs on the streets and making the rounds at parties in Nova Scotia, or anywhere, are prescribed by physicians and funded by government or private insurance companies. It's a frustrating reality for pharmacists, police, and politicians. Just this week, Nova Scotia's Attorney General criticized the province's prescription monitoring program. He said the program has sent up red flags on 2,000 prescriptions, but there aren't enough people managing the system to react quickly by getting in touch with pharmacists and physicians. So the drugs continue to slip through loopholes and end up on the street. When physicians do cut off their meds, addicts often turn to the street trade. But these aren't people who hold down 9-to-5 jobs. They need money to feed their habit. If they can't count on government or private insurance to fund their addiction, how about that guy down the street who owns a smoke shop?
The man who robbed the TJ's convenience with a sawed-off shotgun and robbed the Need store in Aylesford with a sawed-off shotgun, he was addicted to Dilaudid.
The bold ones walk into pharmacies and demand narcotics. But there's been a rash of break-ins and hold-ups along this road. Almost always young people with weapons, threatening store clerks to hand over cash, cigarettes. Amy and I stopped by TJ's, a convenience store and service station in Colebrook, on the edge of Kentville. You used to work here.
Yeah, not at this exact location, but at his other location I did, and never ever had an issue.
As a teenager, you were?
Yeah, I was 17 years old.
Hi, Steve. Hi. I'm Margot from CBC. Steve Marine runs TJ's. and he relies on local teenagers to work the pumps and the cash register.
Come on in my office.
I sort of want you to show me the crime scene, though.
Oh, do you want to see the crime scene?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You know Amy? Steve is fit, strong, friendly. He grew up in the Valley. He's been in this business for more than 2 decades. But lately, he's had to rethink the way he runs his stores. Last winter, TJ's was targeted by armed robbers 3 times in a month.
All the black domes that you see on the ceilings, them are all cameras.
Was it always like that?
No. It's probably taken place in the last 2 to 3 years. But I feel it's got a lot to do with the drug. So it was a guy that came in with a butcher knife, and he came in and demanded cash out of the cash register, and the girl, I don't know what she was thinking about, refused to give him the cash. So he made off with nothing. The third incident was where a customer came in the store and locked himself in one of my cleaning rooms. And after the store had closed, come out of the cleaning room and did his robbery. He probably got about 2 dozen packs of cigarettes before the RCMP, because once he came through the door, the laundromat door, the alarms were going off. So he knew that he only had minutes to do his duty and be out of here.
One of his employees took stress leave. 2 of the robbers are still free. Amy keeps tabs on all the break-ins in this part of the province and sends those stories to everyone on her mailing list. She's sometimes a thorn in the side of police, who say they're trying to catch the culprits and control the drug trade.
I think she's done a tremendous job within the community to raise awareness.
But she's found an ally in this man.
Yes, I'm Mark Mander. I'm the chief of police with the Kentville Police Service. Certainly some people say, well, she sort of rubs the system the wrong way, but that's what you need. You need people to rub the system so that they can create change. Otherwise, the system doesn't listen.
So many fingers point to one clinic as the source of overprescribing in the Valley. What can you say about that?
Well, I think there's certainly a number of people that are concerned about the Mud Creek clinic in our area. I'm not necessarily sure that it's just the Mud Creek clinic. I think it's a prescribing practice all told amongst physicians in Nova Scotia, you know, because we don't always hear information of docs in the Mud Creek clinic that are prescribing or giving persons more pills than what we think they should have. We hear it all over.
So how can you control the crime if nobody's doing, well, they have done something about the prescribing practice lately, tried to train doctors to be more careful, but how can you control the crime in this situation?
Well, I mean, we tend to, through information, we determine, you know, who's selling drugs and where the access is, and we operate on from that perspective, from an intelligence perspective, and target certain individuals. But, I mean, from the prescribing part, you know, where I feel that we need to go is that we need some legislative authority to say, okay, now, this training isn't voluntary. This training is required. The new thing that the physicians come out with, which is a letter of agreement between the client, that should be a requirement, a mandatory requirement.
Not voluntary.
Not a voluntary requirement. You know, and that's where we can start putting more controls on the number of pills that are going out the door.
Good evening. Drug death. Joshua Graves died after taking a prescription drug. His sister's campaign for justice has led to criminal charges.
A 22-year-old man is accused of criminal negligence causing the death of Joshua Graves and trafficking hydromorphone. The CBC's Elizabeth Chu.
That was kind of like a really big moment for me.
That moment came almost 1 year to the day since her brother Josh died.
I never dreamed in a million years that I would be successful in doing that.
Really?
No. Everyone told me I wouldn't. Everyone told me I was crazy. They all thought it was fabulous what I was doing, the advocacy and the awareness and all that was great, but they thought, oh gosh, Amy, don't count on the justice system to help you out, you know. The last people who will admit they made a mistake are the police. That's one thing I really learned from this whole experience is when you're a young kid, you're meant to believe that doctors, police officers, educators, you know, what they say goes. They know it all. They're kind of on a pedestal. Like, don't question. I kind of felt like growing up, you weren't supposed to question those people. There was no need to. But I've learned after Josh's death, you'd have to question those people. They're humans. They make mistakes just like me and you and everybody else. So you have to make them accountable too.
Amy can hardly believe how Josh's death has changed her. Her dream of being a stay-at-home mom with a pack of kids is off the rails for now. Her wedding plans canceled and her relationship failed. But her 2-year-old is not the only person who's depending on her, and she can't turn her back.
It just kind of like my body and my mind moved. I didn't even have to think about it. I like to use the analogy, if you're driving down the highway and you see a car accident, you know, a minivan full of kids, like, what do? Do you keep driving? I mean, it's not something you want to deal with. It's not a pretty picture, but can you really do that? No. You got to stop. You got to turn around and help. When Josh died too, it opened up a whole can of worms. All of a sudden, I was a lightning rod for everyone else who's lost somebody and had a story to tell. And the more stories I heard, the less I could ignore what was happening.
So you spent a lot of time on the phone helping other parents, brothers, sisters, who have family members addicted.
Every day, I'm talking to somebody.
Every day?
Every day. Phone, email. My life is forever changed. There's no turning back. Family and friends say, Amy, the next time, you know, someone calls for an interview, just say no. Next time a family member asks you to call detox for them or asks you to call the Minister of Health, whoever it is, just say no. And I said, yeah, but if I say no, who will? If I don't do it, who will?
In the Annapolis Valley, I'm Margot Brunel for Maritime Magazine.
Our documentary this morning was called Amy's War on Drugs. Next week, we'll hear Margot's conversation with two people who managed to kick the prescription drug habit after a long, tough battle. Until then, please let us know your thoughts about all of this. Call us at 1-800-565-5463 or send us an email, marmag@cbc.ca. I'm Pauline Dakin. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you again next Sunday.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.